This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. I saw a headline that Governor Inslee is proposing a public option for health care in Washington State, which sounds like a big deal. So let's call up the man who is working on this plan. Jason McGill, who is the governor's senior policy advisor for health care. Is this going to be the state's version of Obamacare, Jason?
Hey, good morning, Dave. Thank you. No, not exactly. This is building off of the Affordable Care Act and improving the situation that Congress and the president has really put at risk for many Washingtonians.
So what's the problem you're trying to solve here? There are some counties in the state where, what, there's only one option for people when they're signing up for health care?
Exactly. Two problems here particularly. One is affordability. And one is stability on the individual market here in Washington. So we have, as you've mentioned, 14 counties that have only one plan offered today, and so are at risk of offering, you know, potentially no plan. And then affordability. The individual market is inherently risky. And then in addition to that, the federal changes starting back from President Trump's decision to eliminate the CSRs, the cost subsidies on the exchange, have really increased the price. And of course, the individual mandate and numerous other policy changes that have not helped the situation.
So insurance companies have backed out, presumably because they knew they couldn't make any money by participating. And you plan to step in. But that tells me then that you're going to have to subsidize this in some way, right?
No, we think we can do this through some policy change, some very targeted policy change. And that is, you know, there's three things here. One, state backing. So the state contracting, leveraging the state purchasing power. We insure many people today through our public employee program, leveraging that work. Second, standardizing the plan so it's easier for consumers and it lowers the out-of-pocket costs, which is a real problem.
And then so you're going to use like the bronze, silver, and gold standards that we came to know under Obamacare?
They will remain in effect, and they will be standardized. We will hope to lower the out-of-pocket costs. This isn't a major change. Many states are doing this today. But the major change is the third piece, and that is capping rates, really having an upper limit rate to keep costs down. And we're proposing Medicare rates. People are happy with Medicare. Medicare seems to be working well. It is a fair rate to use.
So this is Medicare for all on a state level. That's what it sounds like.
It is closer to that. In analogy terms, using Medicare as a rate, it is limited in the sense of the individual market. So we're not disrupting people's employer market. Employer choices still exist.
But it means that if you can't get insurance anywhere else, you have essentially the option to buy into Medicare even though you're not 65.
And of course, it wouldn't be Medicare per se. We would be mirroring the Medicare rates using a commercial backed, state-backed commercial plan.
Right. Now, one of the problems is that since the president has suspended enforcing the mandate to buy insurance, people conceivably could just wait until they're sick to purchase the policies, right? Which I thought was one of the big problems that would cause the you know, the death spiral. Only sick people would sign up. Is that a problem for you?
Right. There are multiple facets to making healthcare work. One is the individual mandate. Two are the subsidies, the insurance laws that require things like an open enrollment period. So people have only one chance a year to enroll in healthcare. And the open enrollment period would prevent sort of that cherry picking.
I see. All right. So what does this mean then for people who are basically desperate to get healthcare because they can't find anything in their county?
Well, fortunately, we do have options for people in their county today, so it's not that dire. Open enrollment period has closed, but if you may have lost a job, if you may be lower income, go online today to Washington Health Plan Finder and enroll. Medicaid is open. You can enroll in Medicaid today. Or if you've had a special change, a marriage, a loss of a job, you can go on and enroll for a private plan on the Washington Health Plan Finder today.
Now, in terms of this new plan, this public option plan, when would you roll this out?
2021. So there's a lot. There's a policy change that needs to occur. Then there are contracting changes. And, of course, with an open enrollment period, November of before the year begins, you really need to have everything done. And we can't do that until November 2020 for a January 1, 2021 beginning date.
So give me the type of person who would be most likely to take advantage of this public option.
Somebody in a rural county in Washington who has very limited choices. They would see this as perhaps more affordable. They would hopefully see the rates lower. They might like the standardized plan. It's very clear what is the out-of-pocket cost for them, and it just gives them an additional choice.
And this is not going to cost the state any additional money? You wouldn't need to go to the legislature and ask for a subsidy of any kind?
We're not asking for a further subsidy. Now, few other states have done that, and that has helped in terms of insuring more people. We're going to study that and require a plan to look into what that may be. For low-income working families, that may be necessary to really get universal health care in the state. However, this plan costs in the range of $500,000 for the actuary, the plan design, the contracting to get it up and running.
Well, that's just to get the, okay, $500,000 is the total cost for to get this option going?
Correct. And as if you can imagine, we're using the products that are in place today, again, with the policy changes that we're proposing to keep the costs down and to really cover the entire state. But people would still pay their premium. Hopefully that would be lower. And they would still get their tax credit subsidy through the Affordable Care Act, through the exchange today.
So then give me an idea of what that would cost, let's say, a family of four. Do you know that?
That is a good question. It ranges, of course. Family of four could spend as much as $10,000 out of pocket on a plan of this nature. And, it ranges from what level of income they make and right. What tax credit subsidy they may have. You can go online and you can just put a scenario in. You could put your family income in, and it will spit out the options for you.
So are you keeping to the Obamacare promise that nobody would have to pay more than 7% of their income for insurance?
Yeah, and you know, it's 10% by law, and that still is in effect, and we want to improve upon that.
So right now it's 10%. Nobody should have to pay more than 10% of their income on insurance.
The law requires a 10% that the exchange products, it would be no more than 10%.
Right. So 2021, that means by the time this starts, Governor Inslee would be the president.
I have no comment on that, Dave.
Okay. I just thought I'd give it a try, Jason.
Sorry.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it. Thank you, Jason.
Hey, thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. Listen to you every morning.
Hannah Scott, who is known around here for her courage and her stamina and her willingness to do anything, was the natural choice to be embedded in the legislature this session. And so that's where she is. She was in Olympia for a preview session yesterday with key lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, talking about what they plan to do this year. Here's her report.
When the legislative session starts, there's going to be dozens of new lawmakers, much larger Democratic majorities, and plenty of divisive issues. But there also appears to be some common ground. Among the issues the eight lawmakers at yesterday's preview session agree on is a top priority, mental health reform, including Skagit County Senator Keith Wagoner, one of two Republicans on the brand new Behavioral Health Subcommittee that will tackle everything from issues at Western State to substance abuse.
This is a problem that we have to address. It's gotten ahead of us, and we have to start taking a bite out of that apple now. It's affected all of us, either within our family or a friend of a friend. Those threads go deep in our communities. I think there's broad agreement within the legislature that this is a top priority, so I think we're going to get a lot done.
Democratic Senator Monk Kadingra is chair of the new Behavioral Health Subcommittee and says it's time to look at overhauling the entire system.
Taking a look at what's going on in our schools, then taking a look at what happens with civil commitment, with assisted outpatient treatment. If they get involved in the criminal justice system, what does that look like? Do we do outpatient competency restoration? And then finally, what are we doing with Western State Hospital?
House Speaker Frank Chop backs the governor's proposal to replace Western State with a new facility. Chop, who plans to step down as speaker after this year, says his main focus is going to be on ways to increase the number of mental health workers in our state, including backing a new UW teaching hospital that comes with patient bed space.
As well as in terms of supportive housing, because it's one thing to treat somebody if they have a substance abuse disorder or a mental illness, and if they have nowhere to go, they die on the street. That's what it boils down to.
Which brings us to homelessness, another issue lawmakers seem to agree the state needs to do more on, from building more condos to changing what Senate Minority Leader Mark Schuster called archaic building codes that prohibit mother-in-law apartments, and realizing that the Growth Management Act is not the Ten Commandments and can be changed every now and again.
The other area in homelessness is the agreement of my colleagues and myself that mental health is a key portion. And if you control prices through supply, work on mental health, I think we can make progress.
Senate Majority Leader Andy Billig agrees more supply and other help is needed, but...
So if we look upstream and say, how can we prevent people from becoming homeless in the first place, is going to be a lot more effective than addressing it, the crisis after it happens. So we need to take care of the crisis, but we really, for the long-term solution, have to look upstream.
All of the lawmakers at the preview event also agreed the state needs to do more on education, especially special education. And there were some differences of opinion on other educational issues. But the real difference of opinion, as usual, came with the question of how to pay for all these big priorities. Among the non-starters for House and Senate Minority Leaders J.T. Wilcox and Mark Schuster, the governor's proposed increase to the B&O tax.
This is not the time to grow the size of government. This is the time to manage the size of government. I think my caucus is going to be pretty solidly behind trying to push back against that B&O tax proposal.
And then there's the capital gains tax.
Well, it's an income tax, period. It is an income tax. And so far, I haven't seen any fairness, any willingness to put it in the Constitution where it would be locked in. So, you know, I guess it's maybe not the polite thing, but it's kind of a bait and switch if you go that route.
Even Senate Majority Leader Andy Billig wasn't ready to dive right in on the capital gains tax.
Yeah, I could see myself supporting it, but I would need to know what we're getting in exchange for that capital gains tax.
Still, lawmakers said they were optimistic that they could at least agree on what the issues were.
And Hannah joins us live now. So, Hannah, there isn't even Democratic enthusiasm for an income tax or capital gains tax?
But certainly more so than on the Republican side. But I think what Andy Billig was trying to say there was, I want to know what that money is going to be used for and that it's going to make an impact in making our tax system more fair. So he wants to take a deep look at it before he just says, yeah, rubber stamp yes on it. And the other Democrats there also seem to support it. So we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah. One of the ideas was that it would replace some other tax, like the property tax, which people hate as well, because that is not attached to income. But it doesn't sound like there's any serious talk about that now.
Not so far. Again, this is going to be a monster session, and this is just kind of some of the early priorities. But I guarantee you that we're going to be hearing about property taxes and some sort of relief possibly coming up in this session.
Why are we talking about taxes or raising taxes at all? Isn't revenue up because of the BAFO economy?
The revenue is up, and if you ask the governor about why we need all of this money, the short answer is going to be is that we have to pay for what was passed on McCleary last year, something like $4 billion, I think. So that's the gist. He says the bulk of it is for that. But also, there's a ton of money that is going to be needed. He's asking for nearly $700 million. I believe, for mental health. There's a ton that, again, like $4 billion that needs to go to education and a lot of other things that he says we need to raise this money for.
Kyra's Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
Here he is, our award-winning film critic, Tom Tangney, because he is now so deeply embedded in show business, he gets to vote in the Critics' Choice Awards. And
that's right.
How many years have you had a vote in the Critics' Choice?
Oh, I mean, you know, maybe 7, 8, 9, 10. Can't remember. I had to fight my way to get into the damn organization, but now that I have,
why?
I'm proudly there. Well, the original rules were that you had to be a national critic. Mm-hmm. In other words, you had to be in at least 10 different markets around the country to qualify for the Broadcast Film Critics Association. So I wrote them, again, maybe a decade ago, and just said, okay, listen, you guys are called the Broadcast Film Critics Association. I am the critic at the top radio station in Seattle, a hotbed of film, you know, fanatics.
Right.
I'm on the radio every single week talking about reviews. I've been doing this for 20 years.
Well, plus, MyNorthwest.com is international.
There you go now. But at the time, we didn't have as high a profile. And so I wrote to them and said, listen, this doesn't make any sense. What organization would I belong to if it was not the Broadcast Film Critics Association? I think you're dissing Seattle, you're dissing Cairo, and you're dissing me. So they wrote back and said, well, our bylaws say you have it has to be national. And the justification for that was, I don't know if people care, is that there are too many fly-by-night film critics. They're right. Just like any radio station can say, oh, yeah, hey, Larry, you know, go see this movie and tell me how the Star Wars movie says. So we need to have some kind of qualifications, some restrictions. They said, how would you propose we do this? And I said, I don't understand why you just can't have anybody, come all, establish who you are, what station you're there, you work for, how many years
you've
been there.
Did you point out that you once worked at the Harvard exit?
Exactly. I live movies.
Exactly.
I am the definition of Hollywood. And so I said, what I would do is I would ask for samples, and then they could gauge the quality of my work. They said, that's a great idea. So I sent them three audio versions of my reviews and my written versions, and they said, wow. In fact, one of the movies, it was about the aristocrats, you know, the movie.
Joke,
about,
yeah.
And they said, that is one of the best reviews we've seen all across the land. He says, they ended up changing their bylaws to get me into their organization.
That? The Tangney Clause.
Exactly.
Wow. So and you still talk to us.
Yeah, that's right.
Boy, and does now, he ever.
yeah, that's right. Sorry, that's all the time we have for him. I'm glad to talk about how much he talks to us.
So tell us about your ballot, will you, for the Critics' Choice Award?
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to post my ballot. The ballots are due today. The award ceremony is this Sunday night. I'll be flying down right after my show with my daughter to attend the ceremonies. Dave, I'll actually put on a tux.
Wow.
It's a borrowed tux from my brother. It's not that I do this as often as you do, Dave, but I'll be flying down there. And so we have to post our, or not post, we have to send in our ballots. And I just thought we'd kind of run through, since I know, Dave, you're a member of the Screen Actors Guild, aren't you?
Yes.
Or something like that. So you also will be voting on these things. I just thought I'd kind of run through some of my categories, and we can kind of kick them around if you want to. So Best Picture, we have 10 nominees, just to kind of get people up to speed. Black Panther, Black Klansman, The Favorite, First Man, Green Book, If Beale Street Could Talk, Mary Poppins Returns, Roma, A Star Is Born, and Vice. And I think there's really no choice. There's one movie I think that stands head and shoulders above everything else in this list, and that's Roma. Now, if you haven't heard of Roma, I don't blame you. It's a black and white Mexican film, you know, so it does have subtitles and all.
Naturally.
But it is absolutely out of this world. It's fantastic. It's a kind of a semi-autobiographical reminiscence by the director, Alfonso Cuarón, who won an Academy Award, by the way, for directing Gravity. So this guy's, he's also done a Harry Potter movie. I mean, he's
a mainstream guy.
He can be a very mainstream guy. This is a personal reflection. It's a fantastic movie. And what's interesting about it is that everybody has access to this, even though a lot of people aren't going to want to watch a black and white film with subtitles. It's a Netflix production, which will really be weird. If Roma, which is considered one of the front runners for Best Picture, actually wins, it'll be the first time a Netflix movie that did play in theaters. But it does have that theatrical distribution, but it's also available on Netflix. That everyone within listening range right now, Dave, could go home if you have Netflix and watch Roma. Now, the reason, I don't know if this is going to win. My hunch is it'll be something else. But I don't know if you watched the Golden Globes, Dave, but there were two surprise winners in that for the best comedy musical and the best dramatic film. And that was Green Book and Bohemian Rhapsody. I have faith that my fellow BFCA members will honor what I think is the best, and that's Roma. We'll see. Another big push, I suspect, if we go commercial, will be A Star Is Born. That was one of the movies that is kind of a front runner.
Okay, let's go to actor.
Okay, actor. So the acting nominees, Christian Bale for Vice, Bradley Cooper, Star Is Born, William Dafoe at Eternity's Gate, Ryan Gosling for First Man, Ethan Hawke for First Reformed, Rami Malek, Bohemian Rhapsody, and Viggo Mortensen for Green Book. I'm voting for Ethan Hawke. I'd be surprised if Ethan Hawke wins, but Ethan Hawke plays this tortured minister who's really having a personal and philosophical and theological crisis of conscience in his movie. My hunch, however, is going to go to a more mainstream movie, probably a Rami Malek in a Bohemian Rhapsody. He plays Freddie Mercury of Queen, or even more likely, maybe Bradley Cooper in A Star Is Born.
Actress.
So the best actress, the category, the nominees are Yalitza Aparicio from The Great Roma, Emily Blunt from Mary Poppins Returns, Glenn Close, The Wife, Toni Collette, Hereditary, Olivia Colman, The Favorite, Lady Gaga, A Star Is Born, and Melissa McCarthy, Can You Ever Forgive Me? I'm voting, of course, for Olivia Colman in The Favorite. She is a hilarious, imperious, and pathetic Queen Anne in the movie The Favorite. I think that it's rare to get historical dramas with such comic complexity. I think she's really brilliant, a great British actress. The surprise Golden Globe star winner in this category was Glenn Close.
I love that movie.
Oh, I think, and she's fantastic in that movie. And so I think that she has a good chance at snagging this. But also there's a big push now about Lady Gaga. And if Lady Gaga wins and shows up and sings her acceptance speech in my presence, I might be okay with that kind of vote.
That's right, you're going to be there for all.
That's right, seeing him in the flesh.
My supporting actor.
So supporting actor, I think we'll just quickly go for this. There are a lot of really solid performances, but I don't think anything is so exceptional. So I decided to vote for Michael B. Jordan in Black Panther. It's rare that you can get a nice bit of kind of character complexity in a comic book movie. He plays the so-called villain, and I say that with quotation marks around there. He actually presents an opposite argument about the African diaspora, if you want to go that far, for Black Panther. And then supporting actress, I'm voting for Emma Stone in The Favorite. The Favorite is about two women vying for sort of the choice spot of being the influential advisor to Queen Anne. She and Rachel Weisz go after each other. Rachel Weisz has been winning more of the awards, but I would give it to Emma Stone. I think she's really great as somebody who kind of, you know, claws her way to the top and gets into power.
And they
power.
Have a young actor category?
Yeah, we do. Every organization wants to do something kind of interesting or catch the people's eyes that the Oscars don't do, and they have this young actress category, a young actor or actress, and there are a lot of good ones, but I would just use this chance. I voted for Elsie Fisher in the movie Eighth Grade. If you haven't had a chance to see Eighth Grade, Lady Bird a year ago did, I think, for high school what this movie does for middle school, and she perfectly embodies this 13-year-old mindset. She's so like vulnerable and haughty at the same time, and all of the humiliations of adolescence, I think, really are well portrayed by a very young first-time actress.
And the other categories you're going with Roman the Favorite, but talk about adapted screenplay, Black Klansman. We haven't talked about that film at all.
Yeah, so Black Klansman, it's a really well-reviewed, in fact, it's maybe one of the best-reviewed movies Spike Lee has ever made. And it's based on a real-life incident that happened in the 1970s when a black police officer, a rookie police officer in Colorado, infiltrated the KKK. And how could that be? Well, he did it by phone. And then when it got so close that he had to literally show up, he got a white colleague to infiltrate, you know, the movie for him, infiltrate the KKK for him. It's a really interesting story. Danny O'Neill, who's my guest host this morning, said he read the book that it's based on. He said, the problem, Tom, the book is so boring. And what's interesting is he makes a certain key changes in the movie, Spike Lee and his other writers, to make it more compelling. One is the white officer in the movie is Jewish. In real life, he wasn't. And the reason he makes him Jewish, I think, is to make it more compelling that, listen, you need to care about what's happening to my people, African-Americans, because, listen, the same thing has already happened to you, and it gives you that kind of dramatic thing. And then, very controversially, the movie ends, because it's all about the KKK, the movie ends with shots, literal newsreel footage of Charlottesville. And the kind of parallel there is, like, it's pretty incendiary, but that additional component makes it feel like, hey, this is...
How unusual for Spike Lee.
This is exactly... Spike Lee's not going to get it, you know, if he gets a chance to kind of, you know, punch you in the face. I think it really is effective, and I think because of what they added to the original source material, it deserves a win.
Tom's full ballot posted at MyNorthWest.com. Tom Tiny, thank you.
Thank you.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness. Just before Christmas, two patients at a Chicago hospital formed a very unlikely friendship. And CBS's Adriana Diaz has their story.
At the University of Chicago Medical Center, you wouldn't blame Daru Smith
happy with the kingdom
and Sarah McFarlane for keeping their distance. They were both on the same wait list for the same rare triple organ transplant.
I was like, I don't want to feel like it's a competition thing, like, you know, who's going to live and who's going to die.
Daru has an inflammatory condition that caused organ failure. When Sarah was a child, a virus attacked her heart, and she had a heart transplant at 12. but recently her health deteriorated. Both needed heart, liver, kidney transplants, but no hospital has ever done two in a single year. Doctors don't introduce patients on the same wait list, even if they have different blood types, like Sarah and Daru. But they met at physical therapy, and a friendship began.
I saw him go on a walk. I was like, oh, I should really get up and go do my laps, too.
Sarah was just marathon, you know, knocking out laps. And she would encourage me, like, you know, we got you, Daru. We can slow down a little bit.
She's kind of like a coach.
Yeah. Yeah, motivation.
All right, good job.
That positivity paid off. Days before Christmas, Daru had a donor, a new chance at life, and to see his three-year-old grow up.
To be honest, I felt a little bad at first. And I was like, she also been through so much, too. You know, like, why didn't she go first?
Then, during Daru's surgery, the transplant team got news they could only describe as a Christmas miracle. Sarah got a match, too.
We have patients who have waited 2 days.
Dr. Valuvan Jeevanandam is the pair's heart surgeon. All told, Daru's surgery took 17 hours. Sarah's 20, almost back-to-back.
What do you think it was that brought matches for both of these patients in such a short amount of time?
Fate. It's one of those things about transplant, which is actually spiritual. You control some things, but when donors occur, you have no control over it all. And maybe there is karma in that they're rewarded for their good deeds.
Good deeds, like being open to friendship where others wouldn't, and paying it forward.
Well, usually I don't do the new year, new me stuff. But I can honestly say this year is like new year, new me.
Daru says he wants to become a motivational speaker now. He's still in the hospital recovering. His new friend, she's been released and doing well.
Good news. 740, Chris, your traffic headline.
Got a stall northbound.
Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. And now here he is from that big, beautiful wall of sports.
Is it transparent?
710 ESPN.
Dave, Danny, we try to bring people together. We don't bring walls. We don't segment people.
Well,
it's
a big, beautiful door. But you have to have someplace to hang all your awards and memorabilia.
There are no shutdowns. You know one of the only awards I've won in the sports is I was the hydroplane writer of the year.
No kidding.
Yeah. Back-to-back years.
Wow.
Yeah. While hating the hydroplanes.
See? And that's part of your genius.
Them.
But don't you find you write better about things you hate?
No.
No?
No.
They're in the Stansayers pits, Danny.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Ugh.
So I think we've touched on this earlier, but there, of course, is serious football withdrawal going on, and you have to decide what you're gonna use to fill that void.
This is true. Who are you gonna root for this weekend? What are you gonna do?
Who's playing?
We have a number of games. We have the Saints playing the Eagles.
Okay. Right.
We have the Rams playing the Cowboys. In the AFC, the other conference from Seattle, you have the Chargers taking on the Patriots. And then you've got the other game, which is the Chiefs, and they're going to be hosting the Colts.
Then I'll cheer for the Chargers, because don't we always root against the Patriots?
Yes. Very, very good.
Thank you. Huh.
Yes, that's correct.
I'm going to be rooting for the Chargers, because as a kid growing up, and you know, the Oregon thing in me, I rooted for Dan Fouts. So I had a Dan Fouts Chargers jersey as a little kid, and I think it would just be really cool to have an AFC championship game if they keep going in that little tiny bandbox of a stadium.
That would be entertaining.
Really kind of
Who's
funny.
The quarterback with the long blonde hair again?
That's the kid from Clemson.
Yeah, Trevor Lawrence.
Different sport.
Yeah, he's not there yet.
That's college football. He's 2 years away from the NFL.
Oh, shoot.
The quarterback.
Well, Dave's rooting for him anyway.
The quarterback for the Los Angeles Chargers is Philip Rivers, who I'm rooting for, which is a surprise to me because I've always thought he's kind of a jerk. Huh. He talks a lot. He looks like he's got a punchable face.
Mm.
He's got a face like when his mouth moves, you just imagine like walloping him one. Like give him one. The other thing is he doesn't cuss. Which is...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, now that appeals to me. What's his name?
Correct.
Philip Rivers?
Philip Rivers. That does not appeal to me.
Like, so you're going to punch Brock in the face?
Well,
he doesn't cuss either.
There were times when working with Brock, I felt the need to go home and bathe in sin. I'm going to go home and I'm going to drink a whiskey and smoke a cigarette because it's been entirely too virtuous for me for the past 4 hours. Yes.
You have this problem with a lot of people, don't you?
Yeah, well, only the really virtuous.
You know, the fact that you think he's too virtuous is another reason for me to root for him.
Yes, correct. Yeah. He's got like 10
What keeps
kids?
You from punching Brock in the face? The fact that you would probably be wiped up?
Yes. He would stuff me up. The fact that he's 6'5" and looks like Ivan Drago from the Rocky movies. And I love Brock.
Yeah.
Like, it's... It's more about my feelings of inadequacy. At least that's what my therapist tells me.
Can't relate to somebody who doesn't drop an F-bomb every once in a while. Yeah.
Like, what's that even like, Dave?
Surrounded by depravity.
What's it like? What's that like?
Yeah, how do you express frustration?
It's a wonderful existence.
You say, like, Jiminy Crickets or something?
Are you sure?
I don't need to say anything to express frustration.
That's true. He does give face.
I just get my heat gun and I melt polystyrene bubbles.
But still, there's got to be... I view... like a good old-fashioned flipping off of someone or a string of cringeworthy swears as being the steam release. Like that you've got pipes where they have a steam release valve.
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about.
The whole thing's going to explode, and I worry about you, Dave, because I wonder where your steam's going.
I don't want my name in a police report.
Well, I don't either. That's the idea of swearing, is that I get rid of it before that happens.
I see. So explain the reason that they fired the strength team at the Seahawks.
I don't know. And it's one of the more extreme changes we've seen to the coaching staff. Last year it was...
So these are the guys in charge of exercises and the machines?
Correct. But they're also in charge of, you look at it at a broader thing, keeping players healthy. Mm. Because that's why you train. You train to avoid injury. It's not just
about... Were we that injury-plagued this season?
And that's kind of the question. I didn't think so.
Yeah.
I would not have identified it as, hey, this was a year. But maybe the way guys were available or not made available, something clearly happened here where the Seahawks have decided as a team to go in a very different direction.
Wow.
It includes part of the training staff, so we'll see how far that up the food chain that goes. But you're going to have a new strength and conditioning department.
I hadn't thought about that. But so the fragility of the players is directly related to how they condition themselves?
Yes. Yeah. Oh. And that's the whole idea of not just getting bigger, faster, stronger, but being able to sustain
more
over the health. Chris Carlisle, who was the head strength and conditioning coach, he's been with Pete for almost 2 decades.
Yeah, he was there for the Super Bowl.
His history goes back to USC. Ooh. He came up here there. I'm very surprised. I saw Chris Carlisle, and this is obviously not something that they've done as a knee-jerk reaction. This has probably been years in the making, but it's a pretty significant change for the health and well-being of the team going forward.
Okay. Phillip Rivers, got it. And
try a curse.
That's all I root for.
Just try one this weekend. Let me know.
Danny O'Neill, our sports insider, is brought to you by your Western Washington Sassafras dealer.
Sassafras! Gosh darn it! Shibbida!
You are such a rapscallion.
Sugar!
To Syria. It's been a confusing story. The U.S.-led coalition against Islamic State has... now, we're told anyway, started the process of withdrawing from Syria. This after National Security Advisor John Bolton said the withdrawal of U.S. forces was dependent on the defeat of ISIS and the guarantee of safety of Kurdish allies. This all began when the president just up and announced that we're getting out of Syria. That led to a couple of resignations, including Jim Mattis. Let's go to CBS military analyst and retired Army Major Mike Lyons, who joins us live now. Mike, first of all, the president made a big deal during the campaign about how badly Barack Obama handled withdrawals, saying you never telegraph what you're going to do to the enemy. And yet that's exactly what he did. So where does it stand now?
Well, this morning we got report that there were military vehicles leaving the northeastern part of Syria heading towards Iraq. And the official statement by the U.S. Information group there said that the withdrawal has started. So you're right. The president at first said it was going to be conditions-based, but it looked like he feels now that the conditions are such that we need to start this process. I mean, Barack Obama withdrew 2,000 soldiers a day from Iraq back when he was doing it. We can easily get 2,500 or so soldiers out of Syria within a couple of days, but it looks like this might be a drip, 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 maybe 10 or 15 at a time based on what the report was this morning.
So what is at stake here? I mean, why do we care back here?
Well, I do think that the president instinctively is correct about taking troops out of there. I don't believe that they're keeping the Middle East from, you know, falling to the hands of Russia or Iran. The bottom line is Syria is the client state of both of those countries as it is. And Congress should revisit as to whether or not we should put troops in there. I think, you know, we're violating their sovereignty as a nation, the fact that that civil war seems to be over. So what's at stake is just the president trying to keep a campaign promise. He's going to turn around and do the same thing in Afghanistan, I think, in the coming months, as he just wants to get U.S. out of these entanglements. There's arguments on both sides whether that will be right or not, and you just got to think that the foreign policy community feels pretty strongly we need to stay, and so does the military, but they're vested in a solution because they came up with a solution to put us there in the first place.
So was Jim Mattis wrong about this, and the president right? I mean, I guess what gives people pause is the fact that these members of the military themselves were so upset about this, they left the White House.
I think that this was always the issue of having someone like Jim Mattis as the Secretary of Defense with a military career. And this is why it took congressional approval, because when it ends badly with the president, which is seems to have done now, there's not good feelings, and we've got to figure how to go forward from here. There's real disconnect as to whether or not we should stay there or not. The bottom line is this is civilian control over the military. This is one thing that the president did get right. I mean, he might have not got the announcement correct, and he might have, doing foreign policy by Twitter is not necessarily the way to go, but this is a good example of civilian control by over the military, and the president has been saying, he's been telling the generals for the past 90 days, every 90 days, I want out, and they keep saying we need to renew every 90 days. He just seemed to have run out of patience and realizes, again, 2,000 troops does not make a real big difference inside of Syria.
Yeah. Well, fair enough. So is ISIS defeated?
Well, probably not. They'll linger. The ISIS is not just people on the ground. It's an ideology. It's all the things that go along with it. The question is whether or not they can reestablish a caliphate, a location on the ground. I mean, you use the military to close with and destroy the enemy on the ground. They might own certain pockets or have influence over certain areas inside of places in Syria, but they're very desolate. I mean, the Syrian government's got a challenge reestablishing its own border. But to say ISIS is defeated is more or less an ideology that will depend on other factors, economic and other pressures, that will determine whether or not it ever gets defeated.
I mean, it's a threat to us. I mean, it seems to me that we don't hear about them anymore. I don't hear about them. I don't hear about the Taliban. What I hear about is the crisis at the border. I mean, the president has called it, what did he say? It is death is crossing the border into America, I think was the latest statement today. That's what's got us all terrified now. So that right. is clearly his priority at this point.
Right. Well, I mean, there's always the shiny object that maybe the media chases at times, but does ISIS pose an existential threat to the United States? No, it really never has. It has challenges within that region. It threatens our allies, and it's something that we've got to be concerned about. We've got to be concerned about it spreading. And it's always good to try to fight these wars, 8 time zones from where we are here, and not necessarily make them home games. But it's something that can be contained, and it never was an existential threat. There were sensational things that happened over the past 10 years with journalists and people that were beheaded in front of the cameras. They used that to their advantage. But for all practical purposes, ISIS as the ideology has got to be confronted, not just from a military perspective.
Are they sneaking in across the border?
No, I don't think so. And there's other ways to get into the United States besides just the U.S.-Mexican border and other locations. And any enemy that wants to do that will find a way. I think you've got to argue a border along our southern region there as not necessarily for solving one problem. It's something about if you want to have a country, if you want to have control of an issue, we've got to have something where, whether it's a wall, whether you use technology along with the wall. The wall is just designed to be a physical barrier to stop human movement. I look at things from a military perspective. That's really what the military was going to do. There's places along the border there that there's going to be no reason for a wall because you either couldn't put one in or it wouldn't make sense. And so, but this is a campaign promise. The president's not going to back down. I think he looks at it as, read my lips, no new taxes that hurt yeah. George Bush when he ran for president. So
exactly. CBS military analyst, retired Army Major Mike Lyons. Mike, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave. Have a great weekend.
You too. Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross, Colin O'Brien, Chris Sullivan. The partial shutdown, now 3 weeks old. Tomorrow becomes the longest in U.S. history and a costly one, too, from what I heard on C-SPAN yesterday.
White House estimates indicate the shutdown is costing the U.S. economy more than $1 billion a week.
Beto O'Rourke, the new representative from Texas, decided to Instagram. Did you watch this? He would live Instagram.
I saw screenshots from his mouth wide open, dental tools inside.
Yeah, he was Instagramming his dental hygiene session because his hygienist was an immigrant who had come across, had grown up near the border and became a citizen, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the issue du jour, and I talked with Margaret Bennett about this earlier this morning, and I told her that it appears to me that there's irrationality at work on both sides here. So I asked her whether she can point a finger at any particular party or person who is being particularly unhelpful to getting this resolved.
The thing that seems most unhelpful on both sides is this rhetoric, this, you know, Speaker Pelosi saying not $1 for a wall, no way, or others on the Democratic side characterizing a call for beefed up border security to be laced with racism, right? That's mm-hmm. one thing that Republicans really balk at, saying just because you want more border security funding doesn't mean you're a racist, right? That's going too extreme. On the Republican side of things, the president's focus on this wall has really driven attention to just that rather than what some others in the administration say they'd like to see, which is increased border security that perhaps Democrats would agree to and already have in terms of increased screenings or increased technology to look at ports of entry, not just the wall itself. The president in many ways has boxed himself in with this focus in the campaign on this one solution. His administration's talking about others, but he only seems to be articulating this one thing about the wall. And so he's boxed himself in there too. So you've got both sides sort of trapped by their own language, trapped by some of the more extreme elements of their own parties. But you do have those in the middle, like in the Senate, you had Senator Dick Durbin, you had Senator Lindsey Graham saying, maybe there's a way we can negotiate things here in terms of beefed up border security that doesn't necessarily have to be only characterized as the president has at this point. And now you have them sort of throwing up their hands.
Well, if Mexico would just pay for it and hold up its end of the bargain. Is Mexico paying for it, by the way? The president keeps saying, yes,
no.
It is. It's not.
No. New Mexico is not. The president said on the campaign they'd write a check. Now he says he never said that. He's also now saying that somehow Mexico ultimately, theoretically, is paying a cost because he says there's this new advantageous trade deal. Remember, that trade deal hasn't been signed off on by the U.S. Congress, the Mexican government yet fully, or the Canadian government yet fully. So it's only an agreement on paper not worth much until it's actually enacted into law. So Mexico has not paid $1 for any kind of border wall that the president promised. This is really, again, the rhetoric, the most unhelpful thing here. The president likes to say he makes promises and delivers on them, and in this case, it's hurting him.
You're also going to be talking with the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, about this shutdown. I think what frustrates people who are, let's say, not C-SPAN watchers is anything being accomplished here, or is this all just a waste of time as both sides stake out positions for 2020? Is there any real negotiation going on?
In the past 24 hours, it appears negotiation, what little negotiation there was, has fallen apart. Senator Lindsey Graham, who has been an ally of the president on this, but was also trying to find a compromise in getting some kind of trade here, get money for the border wall in exchange for offering something to Democrats like protection for so-called dreamers, those who came here illegally as children. He has been trying to offer this way forward, this off-ramp. Last night, he said he's never been this discouraged, and he gave up. It just appears that, you know, Republican leadership in the Senate doesn't want to put forward any kind of bill like that unless the president promises to sign it. And the president isn't willing at this point, it appears, to make a bigger trade to get this wall. He just wants the sort of vote here to fund the wall or not, in addition to other border security. So now the conversation seems to be among lawyers at the White House about what other ways could they go to get emergency funding to bypass Congress, essentially, build the wall without getting our elected representatives to sign off on it.
Margaret Brennan, host of CBS's Face the Nation.